Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a special presentation. We'll be doing this in two parts. Today, we are taking an honest look at what we have learned about the entire course of the War on AIDS, and what I'm calling the truth deniers, those individuals who are in a position to know the truth about AIDS and yet have kept this from the American public. They've even gone further to try to destroy the reputations and lives of people who are honest, objective, have taken a real careful look and have said, we've done this all wrong. To those people, they call them AIDS denialists. They include me as well. We will prove and share our evidence that what we're now looking at is probably the greatest medical fraud in history, and that these people, in my personal opinion, should be tried in a court of human rights because there's no statute of limitations on crimes against humanity, and this certainly rises to the extent of causing hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. People affiliated with the pharmaceutical company's bad science, people then engaging in misinformation, disinformation, and anyone who stands up, they attack. You'll hear three of those people who've been attacked on today's program, including Charles Ortlieb, the publisher of the New York Native, the most respected and read gay publication in American history from 1980 to 96. And it was Charles who led the way of doing quality, independent research on the subject of AIDS. Now, none of the people I know deny AIDS. That's ridiculous. We do not deny that the 30 conditions called AIDS are real. They are all real. They can injure people. They can kill people. The questions arise, and what is the actual cause? It is a single retrovirus, HIV, or is it lifestyle, such as especially in the 70s and 80s, the amyl nitrate that they call poppers, which are known to suppress the immune system, alcohol, staying up all night, partying, unprotected anal sex? Is it some other variation of combinations that can cause this? Is it the human herpes 6 virus that there are thousands of studies on showing that it creates the same symptoms as HIV? And why is it different in Africa than in the United States? And why is it that after all these years, from 1984 till today, why is it that it still stay in the same subset of fast-track gays, intravenous drug users, and hemophiliacs, but has not spread and decimated the larger heterosexual community? I challenge that all of the mainstream media has been complicit in this disinformation campaign. I challenge that publications, organizations, gay organizations, straight organizations that receive money from the manufacturer of these toxic drugs should have been more in perseverance of the truth and deconstructed the arguments, but they didn't. I also challenge those who would attack, libel, and slander, even give death threats against anyone who opposed them, especially in the gay community. We have an epidemic of gay-on-gay hate that has not been a focus. As you will hear later from Charles Ortlieb, we need a new gay revolution in America, just as Stonewall was a gay revolution. We need a new one and throw out those people within the gay community from having positions of power who use their power in what many people consider the most self-serving, selfish, and deadly way. To help us better understand this, I've invited from Canada one of the world's leading journalists on the subject, David Crowe. David is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS and Rethinking AIDS, whose website he hosts at rethinkingaids.com, and where they review the science and news sources of all international research and commentaries challenging the current HIV/AIDS model. He is also the former president and treasurer of the Green Party of an Alberta candidate, and he hosts the radio show Infectious Myth on the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Nice to have you with us today, Dave.
Thank you for having me on your show again, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into this, let me just state that I knew from the very beginning of my research on AIDS that something was amiss. I just didn't know what. And once I began to see from whistleblowers and people telling me that what they believed, people within the gay community, what they believed was causing AIDS, and I researched that, this was not what was being touted in the mainstream or the scientific media. And because I'd done research and articles by the hundreds on cancer, on mental illness, on environmental disease, I'm used to going into kind of a sacred place, sacrosanct, and you're not allowed to challenge them. You're not allowed to rock the boat. Otherwise, they're very vindictive. A whole vindictive goes against you. So when it came to AIDS, I didn't realize how small a group, just a handful of individuals, virtually controlled everything on AIDS. But all these scientists lined up, all these clinics lined up, and what would be a lifetime of funding into the hundreds of billions of dollars were to flow that way, providing that no one challenged some basic assumptions. Well, but the scientists I were talking with, the doctors, the people within the AIDS community, the gay journalists, they were telling me, we're getting misinformation. So after I did my research, my publisher decided to publish this. But here's what the audience should know. Every single article I wrote on AIDS was formally vetted by one of the top lawyers. I believe she was a Harvard law, Trudy, and she was hired by the publisher to make sure every single statement in every single article was accurate and verifiable. And it was, or it didn't get published. In addition, I had my own scholars and residents review it and my own internal legal staff. So we know the information we published is accurate. What I didn't know was that just to even question a dogma was tantamount to being attacked. You were an AIDS denier. So here's what I want the public to know that I've done, and I want them to go to my website today and review this for themselves. What do I have there? I have a textbook I wrote on AIDS called AIDS, a Second Opinion. The publisher, Seven Stories Press, was so concerned, since he is the leading publisher within the liberal community, that the people heading the attack against any dissenters were liberals disguised within the gay community, that he hired Professor Jim Feast to review and verify every single fact in this test book. So I wrote a textbook, 700 pages with 3,000 references. The largest chapter in there is on natural approaches to AIDS treatment. I wrote the longest article in the history of the Townsend Letter for Doctors and Patients on natural treatments for AIDS and positive studies when you reverse unhealthy lifestyle. I wrote 12 articles. All 12 are there. All show AIDS exists. No one's denying that. But I believed in a more natural, less toxic way of approaching it, and I wrote about it. I then did what would turn out to be 5 documentaries, all posted, showing natural approaches to reversing AIDS. You'll see the people. You hear their stories. And then I also show the politics, the pain and the profit, that those who were profiting, the drug companies, those people they could buy or influence, were supporting their view that AZT was the only way you should approach it initially. And yet I saw hundreds of thousands of people dying like flies taking AZT. And when I wrote about AZT, which also motivated John Lawrence and others to write about it, and Celia Farber, all of us were attacked. Not because we gave misinformation, but because we were challenging the profit base and the political stranglehold a tiny little group of people within the AIDS gay community had on the subject of AIDS. So here, what do we have? We have a press conference. You can see right up there on the website. And the big banner, AIDS is not a death sentence, with a group of esteemed scientists in a room with 100 doctors and their patients, all of whom reversed or improved their AIDS condition using natural therapies. And not a single member of the AIDS community or gay community or the media showed up. Not one single person. That should have been revolutionary. That should have been headline news. 100 different approaches to AIDS, all using natural techniques and all working. Nope, but if you brought out a toxic drug, you got all the attention in the world. I also have the largest lecture ever done on the subject of AIDS that I'm aware of. It was at a church which lasted 12 hours. It lasted from 10 in the morning to 11 at night. Over on Central Park West, where 1,700 people showed up, and I brought people in who were clinicians and scientists from China, from Japan, from around the world, presenting natural approaches to AIDS all day long. And then finally, I have 1,200 individuals who I personally work with in our medical center, the Tri-State Healing Center, and 12 of those people completely cured, reversed their AIDS-defining illnesses completely. Tony Brown heard about it, sent his researchers over. They took time. They reviewed the patient records, interviewed the patients, and they brought over 2 years. They brought eight of those people on Tony Brown's journal on PBS. So I had cured people with AIDS. I had personally treated with our group more people than anyone else using natural therapies. I had greater success. I took the full burden of paying for that therapy on myself. I was working 12 to 14 hours a day working with people with AIDS. So imagine how it feels when you've written a textbook on natural approaches and the politics. You've written articles. You've done 5 award-winning and documentaries, including AIDS the Real Hero, showing their natural journey. I did a press conference. I did an all-day conference. And yet I am called an AIDS denialist. And they get that up on Wikipedia that I'm suing, by the way. Major lawsuit, class action lawsuit. I'll talk about that on an upcoming show. And all the other scientists, all the other journalists, all the others, thousands were also painted with the same brush. And yet no one in the media will touch it. No one within their committee will touch it. So I want people to see the truth because my audience thrives on the truth. My audience knows the truth, and they can share that with other people the next time someone says, oh, you know, you're dealing with AIDS denialists. Oh, no. To the contrary. There's no human being on the planet they can show has cured more people of AIDS than I have, spent more hours every day for decades with them, and got them healthy. Put it in a textbook, press conference, 5 documentaries, all award-winning, and articles and lectures. And yet, that's still out there, that dogma. Take it from there, please, and show us what your research into all these thousands of people who now are doing what I did, questioning what we've been told about AIDS and showing its fallacies.
Yeah, well, you said that nobody denies AIDS, but in actual fact, AIDS is a syndrome that is a bunch of existing diseases that is only AIDS if HIV is present. So if you take HIV away, it's not that the diseases don't exist, but AIDS doesn't make sense. What's also really important to know is that there are 3 major definitions of AIDS in use around the world. In 1993, the Americans allowed low CD4 immune cells, a low count of CD4 immune cells, with a positive HIV test to be considered AIDS without any AIDS-defining illnesses. And that was not adopted by any other Western countries. They stuck with the 30 different disease definition. And so the number of cases in America is completely out of line with those in other Western countries in terms of the per capita number. So what that means is, at the very least, America is over-diagnosing AIDS. And once you're diagnosed with AIDS and you're terrified because you have this fatal illness, of course you're going to go on the drugs, which now for a single pill a day cost about $30,000 a year. And, you know, the patients obviously in very few cases pay it. It's either paid by insurance companies or more likely paid by the U.S. government. So it's basically a hidden subsidy to the pharmaceutical companies. But there's a third definition of AIDS, which was defined in 1986 in a city called Bangui in the Central African Republic. And that basically says, if you have fever, cough, diarrhea, weight loss, serious rash, if you have any 3 of those things, and in the absence of an HIV test, not without necessarily having an HIV test, it's AIDS. So they basically redefined poverty and malnutrition in Africa as AIDS. And so all of a sudden there was this massive epidemic of AIDS, which has no relevance, no relationship to AIDS in America. In America, you don't need to be sick. Most people with low CD4 counts are not sick with an AIDS disease when they get diagnosed. But in Africa, you have to be sick, but you don't necessarily have to have an HIV test. They just assume if you have 2 or 3 of the symptoms that you have this disorder. But in my research, I basically found that every part of the HIV/AIDS death dogma is wrong. It starts with the HIV test that Gallo patented in 1984 first. Then he had a press conference to announce that he'd found the probable cause of AIDS. Then he published the science, which is completely the wrong way around. But I guess what it means is money is most important, prestige is second important, and science takes a distant third place. But he published papers claiming that he had an HIV test. But he couldn't have validated that test, and it's clear in the papers he didn't validate that test, because that would require purification of HIV. And to this day, that has not been done. And that's one of the most stunning facts about AIDS. Another stunning thing is, even if you believe all the HIV tests that they have, the antibody tests, the PCR tests called viral load, a whole bunch of other things that are mostly restricted to the labs, like cell culturing, things like that, even if you believe that, they've been unable to show how HIV kills immune cells. A paper by Gallo basically found HIV, according to his own definition, in only one out of several thousand immune cells. And given that the immune system is dynamic and replicates itself on a regular basis, you can't wipe the immune system out by killing a tiny fraction of the immune system every day. You would have to infect a significant percentage so that you could actually degrade the immune system. So if you don't know how HIV causes immune deficiency, you don't know that it does cause immune deficiency. And another aspect is that this has always been considered to be mostly a sexually transmitted disease, but in the famous Padian paper from 1997, she followed serodiscordant couples, one positive, one negative, and in none of those couples did she find the negative person becoming HIV positive. That information was buried deep within the paper. It didn't make it into the abstract, and nothing has come along since to contradict that. And in research in Africa, there are many things that contradict this idea that AIDS is that HIV is sexually transmitted and then causes AIDS. And then the causation part of it, the AIDS establishment has invented two interesting terms. One is called long-term non-progressor, and one is called elite controller. And for a lot of things, they're really the same thing. But what it basically means is you're HIV positive for a long time, you don't have any illness, and you're not taking AIDS drugs. This kind of contradicts the whole theory. Scientists kind of quietly admit that these people exist. They try to pretend that it's a very small number, but they have no way of knowing how many of these people there are, and claim that they have some special gene or something like that. But if those people had taken AIDS drugs, they might have come down with the symptoms of AIDS, because the first AIDS drug produced, AZT, also known as retrovir and azithromycin, in the manufacturer's documentation for the drug, the prescribing label, it says it's difficult to distinguish the side effects of this drug from the progression of AIDS. So the first drug, AZT, for AIDS, can actually cause the symptoms of AIDS. So how many people went on AZT, as their doctors predicted, they came down with the symptoms of AIDS, and the doctor said, see, I was right. Just think if you hadn't started the drugs sooner. But what if they hadn't? Maybe they never would have had those symptoms. And although AZT is not really extensively used today, mostly because it's gone off patent, so now generics are available and it's much cheaper, AZT is nowhere in the range of $30,000 a year, like the newer patented drug. But every so-called AIDS cocktail or combination therapy contains at least one drug in the same class of AZT, the nucleoside analogs. Nucleoside analog means it directly interferes with DNA synthesis, so it interferes with your cells dividing. So you can imagine what would happen if you gave that to, say, a pregnant woman with a rapidly dividing fetus, or you gave it to a young child who was born HIV positive? What does it do to your immune system that, as I mentioned earlier, has to replicate on a regular basis? A nickname for these drugs is nukes, and that's basically the effect of these drugs on the body. People are living longer, but they've also dramatically reduced the dose of these drugs. In the mid-1980s, when AZT was being initially trialed, the dose was 1,500 milligrams per day. Now it's 200 or 300. So obviously, if you reduce the dose of the poison, people are going to live longer. Combine that with the fact that you're now diagnosing people without any illness. So if you diagnose relatively healthy people, or at least not an AIDS-defining illness, if you diagnose much healthier people and give them a lower dose of poison, well, of course, they're going to live longer, and then you can claim success. Now people are living 10 or 20 years instead of 1 year. but it really doesn't mean anything. All of these questions are still outstanding. One of the arguments against discussing this is that we've been talking about it for too long. We were talking about this in the late 1980s. A number of critics, including yourself, were criticizing the HIV-AIDS theory back then. Dr. Peter Duisberg, the Perth Group, there were a number of them. Those people, the ones who are still alive, are still criticizing the HIV-AIDS theory. But scientists will say, well, look, we talked about it for 10 years. It's over now. Just stop. Just stop. But the questions have never been answered. So why should a scientist who doesn't believe a theory that is believed by the majority of people, why should that scientist shut up? I mean, would we ever have an Einstein if scientists were told, you know, Newton figured out physics, so just shut up and don't tell us all these crazy things about time slowing down and all that kind of stuff. Just go with the flow. And unfortunately, a lot of scientists do that. And it's all driven by money because they survive on grant funding and their salaries, and that continues to grow and improve if you are well-behaved, if your science doesn't rock the boat. And it's really a myth and a lie to say that scientists are looking for something radical. Generally, they're looking for something incredibly small that fits within the existing paradigms. And this will continue until the paradigm collapses, which it must eventually.
Now go through some of the other contradictions. When I work with people with AIDS-defining illnesses, and I have over 1,200 personally, and the medical team I work with, we were looking at people, and consistently we found people whose immune systems were extremely fragile or destroyed, mainly by lifestyle conditions. And so we rebuilt those systems. It generally took us an average of 16 months on a regular weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis. The ones that reversed completely, the 12 that reversed completely, that went on Tony Brown's journal. Interesting enough, by the way, here you have 12 people whose AIDS-defining illnesses were reversed completely. Medical documentation, blood workup, everything was perfect. And a whole group of medical doctors who were part of that team standing there to verify it. In comes Tony Brown. 8 of those people show up on his show. Then word gets into the African-American community. And then Bill Tatum of the Amsterdam News and Arthur Ashe and Stokely Carmichael and a whole group of African-Americans show up at the center, and they want to see what's going on. And we have opened. They can come in and talk with people. And they did. And so the word got out in the African-American community of what AIDS was and what it was not, and how to work with it, how to heal your body. And so it was rather ironic that the word on the street in the African-American community was, you know, build up your immune system. But that never translated, because of institutional racism, from the African-American community into the mainstream Caucasian community.
I think a really good illustration of the problems with HIV-AIDS theory is hemophiliacs, which really make up only a tiny proportion of the people who have been diagnosed with HIV infection or AIDS over the year, and I put infection in quotes. But around the time that AIDS was defined in 1981, it was called gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID back then, most hemophiliacs had what they called intermediate purity factor 8. This is the clotting factor that they needed to stop bleeding to death. And intermediate purity factor 8 was really very impure. It was derived from blood products. About that time, they started to develop what they called high purity factor 8, which was, I believe, genetically produced by genetic engineering. It had a very high purity and very little extraneous proteins. So some experiments that were done back then showed that the more factor 8, the intermediate purity factor 8 you'd had over the lifetime, the more likely you were to be HIV positive. And so what this is saying is the more your immune system has been challenged with foreign proteins that are not factor 8 but just are carried along in the infusions, carried along for the ride, that have an immunosuppressive effect, the more that you inject over a lifetime, the more likely you are to be immune suppressed. So lower CD4 counts, the more likely you are to be HIV positive. So it appears that the HIV test may be a marker of immune suppression, at least in some people, but it was very closely related to the use of factor VIII. Now, there was an article published in Lancet in the 90s that followed hemophiliacs in the United Kingdom. And what the authors said is that this article proves that HIV is the cause of AIDS because only HIV-positive hemophiliacs had a higher death rate. And that was actually true, but it was a distortion because what happened is the death rate between HIV-positive and negative was not really very different up till 1987, but in 1987 it diverged. The HIV-negative hemophiliac death rate stayed pretty much the same. HIV-positive went through the roof. What happened in 1987? Well, that was the year when AZT, which I've already talked about, was approved. Hemophiliacs, of course, were told this is your only chance to survive. You have HIV, it's going to lead to AIDS, you must take AZT. And the vast majority of them took AZT, and there was this holocaust of hemophiliacs, a whole generation of hemophiliacs, especially the more severe hemophiliacs, because, of course, they were more likely to be HIV positive, were wiped out. I have a friend who was he's been a hemophiliac all his life, of course, but in 1987, he was offered AZT, and he was a child at the time, and he declined. And when he became an adult and could make his own decisions, he continued to refuse the AIDS drugs. But being a hemophiliac, of course, there's limited clinics in any big city. There may only be one clinic for hemophiliacs, so you get to see all of the others. And he gradually saw the other hemophiliacs get sick and die because the vast majority were taking AZT. So hemophiliacs are this tragic experiment where AZT was given and the hemophiliac died, and the evidence is that it was AZT that was killing them, not HIV.
Talk about the test, because a lot of people believe if they get an HIV antibody test positive, they must immediately go on the drugs.
Yes, well... And that's basically what they've been pushing for. At first, they would give you an antibody test, and then they'd check your immune cells. And if your immune cells were high, they'd say you can wait. But gradually, they've said, we need to hit hard, hit early. It gets you on the drugs right away. But what are these HIV tests? Like, why an antibody test? In Gallo's research in 1984, he found that about 90% of people with so-called AIDS were positive on his antibody test, but only about 50%, less than 50%, by cell culture. Now, cell culture is clearly closer. If there really was an HIV virus, then culture is closer to detecting the virus than antibodies. But they basically ignored the results from cell culturing. They didn't say half of these people we're testing actually don't really have AIDS because the culture is negative. They just said, we like the antibody test, because it's proven positivity. But you have to ask yourself, how did Gallo know that these people had AIDS in the absence of a test for HIV? Because AIDS, it's only AIDS if you're HIV positive. If you have tuberculosis, if you're HIV negative, it's tuberculosis. If you're HIV positive, it's AIDS. So how was he able to define the people in his experiments as having AIDS when he had no HIV test? He was developing an HIV test. So he arbitrarily defined people as AIDS, assumed that they had a virus causing their symptoms, and then produced a test which was positive in about 90% of the people. Well, all of those people probably had a hyperactive immune system because they were sick, and so a test which tests for a hyperactive immune system would do the job. It would appear to be a test for the virus that you have just assumed is present. In about 10 years, 13 years actually, after they developed the HIV theory, I think in 1997, so this is 13 years after 1984 when Gallo announced he'd found the probable cause of AIDS, they actually put the what they called the purified virus, what they had obtained from cell cultures, they actually put it under an electron microscope for the first time, which is actually pretty amazing. It took them 13 years to do that. when they looked at it, they realized that at least 90% of what they were looking at was impurities. So if you're deriving a test based on the materials you find out of the cell culturing process, and 90% of those materials are impurities, how do you know that the antibodies, the antigens, the genetic material that you're actually extracting actually came from viral particles? Clearly, you have to purify HIV, and it has not been accomplished to date. And I feel that it never will be accomplished. I actually listened to a speech that Luc Montagnier gave when, I think it was just after he won the Nobel Prize in Calgary. And what really struck me, and this says a lot about Montagnier's personality, so he started off by giving a very mainstream speech about HIV and AIDS, how many people had died, the wonders that drugs had done, and it's like I could have taken it off the website of the CDC or something like that. But then he started talking about oxidative stress, and he was very careful. He talked about all the diseases that are diseases of oxidative stress, including AIDS and a variety of others, and then he talked about one of those other diseases and how it can be cured by nutrition. He didn't specifically say that HIV could be. But you know that's what he thinks. But he also knows that when he's in front of an audience of several hundred people, that he can't say what he said when he was comfortable in that interview with Brent. Afraid I can't remember Brent Young. He was very comfortable, and so he told what he really believed. One thing I got from the interview is if you turn it around, he said, if you have a good immune system, you can fend off HIV. But if you turn that around, you can say, if you have a suppressed immune system, you're vulnerable to an infection by HIV, and then supposedly HIV causes your immune system to decline. But if you can only get HIV because your immune system's declined already, then you don't need HIV in the equation. He's basically saying if you've got a suppressed immune system, you got a suppressed immune system. And so he's trying to keep the HIV theory alive, but if you think carefully about what he said, there's no need for it. Another thing he said early in the 80s and the 90s regarding HIV and AIDS was that he believed that there were certain cofactors that were necessary for HIV to cause illness. But he didn't know what those cofactors were. He had some ideas, but he didn't actually have any solid evidence of what these cofactors were. So why couldn't it be that one of those cofactors could do all of the damage by itself, like in inhalant nitrites, the poppers, for example? Cofactors was just a way for Montagnier to have it both ways. He could keep the HIV theory that had made him famous, but he could try to escape some of the obvious contradictions of the theory that I've gone through. And I think ultimately, of the two main characters, the Robert Gallo who didn't get the Nobel Prize, his character is as a bully, and that's what he's done all his life, is he's pushed people around, and Luc Montagnier is a coward, and he allows himself to be pushed around. People have expectations, so he gives a speech which has those expectations. Gallo pushed him into giving all of his science to Gallo so Gallo could claim it for his own. Two people with very interesting and distinct personalities created this virus theory, and I don't think good science played a role at all. It was two people trying to get the Nobel Prize. Luc Montagnier, it was kind of the tortoise and the hare, and Luc Montagnier was the tortoise, but he ended up making it to the finish line, and Gallo's shenanigans, to put it mildly, were so well known amongst the scientific community that they couldn't possibly give him the Nobel Prize. Everybody knew too much. But, of course, they weren't going to say anything in the Nobel Prize citation because they don't really want the wider public to know. I mean, I can recommend John Crutzen's book, Science Fiction's The Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo, which was published in the early 2000s. It's a pretty deep book. It's hard reading, but if you want to know what Robert Gallo did that was wrong and why they had to call in the Secret Service in order to investigate what was going on, there's a lot of surprises. in that book. There's a lot of shock. Like, could it really be that bad? Like, for example, that Luc Montagnier had a patent application that went to the U.S. Patent Office and languished, whereas when Gallo submitted a patent application much after Luc Montagnier, it shot through at the speed of light. Clearly, the U.S. government was putting its fingers on the scales. I think it was putting an elephant on one side of the scales, actually.
David, we're out of time for this segment because we have John Lauritsen coming on, and also we have Charles Ortlieb.
Thank you, Gary. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. David Crow, and he has the names. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In this segment of our program, we're going to speak with a person that I personally consider one of the most important voices within the gay liberationist movement, John Lauritsen. John is one of those individuals who, when seeing the truth, will not hide behind any lie or distortion of that information. So back in the 1980s, when he was exploring AZT, he found contradictions between the official position that it was safe and effective and it would put time on your side and could be the first major life-enhancing part of the AIDS community's armamentarium against AIDS. John wrote a series of articles. He would also later write a book. Now, here's what people are not aware of, and this is the message I'm going to share today. There were a handful of gay journalists, including someone you'll hear later on the program, Charles Ortlieb, the founder of the New York Native, the most popular gay publication in America, and all the gay journalists who supported, let's reevaluate what we're doing with AIDS and the drugs treating them, they were all attacked. Not only they were attacked, but they were vilified, their reputations destroyed. Now, no one in the mainstream media covered this. In fact, this was really not covered within the gay media because the advertising went to certain publications, and those publications allowed this demonization or exclusion to happen. So John was a part of that. He was a victim of it. And I want him to talk about what it was like once you find the truth about AZT and you try to tell your community the truth and you're set upon by people within that same community. John, the forum is yours.
Well, okay. I had written debunking the HIV hypothesis before AZT, but the Chuck Ortlieb and the New York Native supported me, and all of my articles were published. It wasn't merely that the studies, you know, which were used to approve AZT were flawed. There was blatant fraud, and my article, FDA Finds Fraud in, you know, AZT Trials, is online. Criminal acts were committed by these so-called researchers, mainly in the Boston area, and yet none of them have even received a slap on the wrist. They've gone scot-free for crimes which resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. But as far as the effects, you know, to me personally for writing this, I've received everything from death threats, which I did when I co-authored a book with Hank Wilson on the dangers of poppers or the nitrite inhalants. And when you get a death threat from the mob, you know, you take it seriously. And we decided to go ahead, you know, warning gay men about the dangers of poppers. But to protect ourselves, we did so politically, trying to make sure that the mob would lose more by killing us than by, you know, letting us go. It turned out, you know, that what we did probably reached a lot of people, but, you know, it didn't seriously affect their market. But anyway, AZT, I have a magazine here, a slick freebie in the Boston area, and it has three full pages of ads for one anti-HIV drug and five full pages of advertising for still another one. So this is partly why the gay media, you know, from way, way back, it's the profit thing. I mean, a great deal of money is to be made by going along with the these poisonous anti-HIV drugs. As in the past, a lot of money by running ads for poppers. But anyway, as far as my personal life and reputation, I have been attacked viciously again and again and again in the gay press and outside the gay press. I have certainly been ostracized, and my other writings have suffered as a result of it. Right now, I've been a regular contributor for the Gay and Lesbian Review, which is the best of all of the existing gay publications. And I write for it regularly, not often, but maybe a couple times a year. And I've written on quite a few different things, but the one thing I cannot discuss at all is anything related to AIDS and HIV. You know, my editor made it clear, and so I simply am silenced on that thing. Well, I don't know. Did you have other questions?
Yes. Do you know who these people are? Or do you know, are these leading members of the gay community or just specific small group who in some way either have an ideological, political, or economic gain by aligning themselves with the corporate interest?
Well, of course, when it gets to the the gay publications, and of course the main gay publications to me are just, they're opposed to everything I stand for. They're totally commercial, and so they're a lost cause. But the great masses of gay people have been brainwashed enough that for them merely to hear that I'm a HIV denialist or an AIDS denialist sort of writes me off, you know. They may make an effort to find me likable, but it's sort of a losing thing.
And I just want you to know that we appreciate all your decades of effort. Charles Lauritsen, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay, thanks, Gary.
In a moment, the publisher of the most respected and widely read gay publication in American history, The New York Native. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is a special, in-depth review of the question of AIDS, and especially those people who, in my opinion, are personal heroes because they had the courage to stand up against those who had aligned themselves either ideologically, politically, emotionally, or financially with special interest groups, like the makers of the AIDS drugs, including and especially AZT. The most important gay publication in the United States for years was the New York Native. It was created by the publisher Charles Ortlieb, a journalist, novelist, filmmaker, who gained an outstanding reputation as a publisher of the Gay Biweekly from 1980 to 1996. The Native was the first major publication to take the AIDS epidemic seriously and question the AIDS hypothesis. The publication brought important individuals such as Dr. Peter Duisberg to public attention. Rolling Stone journalist David Black claimed Chuck's New York Native deserved a Pulitzer Prize, and the New York Times called it visionary. He's also written many novels and plays, and Celia Farber has called his novel Iron Peter the Animal Farm of the AIDS era. And his most recent book is A History of the Early AIDS Era from a Real Pioneer and Insider, Truth to Power, The New York Native, 1980-96. And you can find more information about Chuck and his books and writings at charlesortlieb, O-R-T-L-E-B, .com. Nice to have you with us, Charles.
Hi, Gary.
Charles, I'm going to raise three questions and take them as you will, and so we can get your perspective. When you began to see, as an investigator and as a journalist, as well as Nina Ostrom and all other journalists that work for you, that what we were being told by the AIDS community was questionable. There were legitimate concerns that this was neither accurate But the consequences of being wrong, for example, in putting the signs up all over New York, put time on your side, take AZT, were deadly. So you went about doing your homework first, supporting your evidence with articles, and then you got into an enormous battle with those within the pharmaceutical industry and those within the gay community that were supported by the pharmaceutical industry on some level to attack you. And those attacks went on endlessly. You were called an AIDS denialist, as were the people that worked for you or published in your publication. What was it like? How did you feel at any time? Did you feel that this kind of gay-on-gay attacks, when the gays had been under attack, and those of us who support gay rights and love gays as special human beings said, why is this going on? You know, you just been able to have some freedoms and dignity in the mainstream press. Why is this going on yet? No major media touched this. It was as if you don't touch this. So one side ended up being extraordinarily aggressive. We just finished speaking with John Lurtzen about death threats and destroying his career. Tell us your story, please. The forum is yours.
Well, I try to tell the story in Truth to Power, one of the books that's at charlesortlib.com. But it was a real roller coaster. And, you know, when we started out, we were the beloved newspaper of the gay community because for 2 years we basically covered science and medicine the way most newspapers do, which is we just reported what we were being told. And the transformative moment for me came when I caught one of the scientists at the CDC lying about something, and that sort of opened my eyes, and I started asking questions. And you know, at the point we started asking questions, we weren't so beloved anymore in the gay community. And, you know, AIDS activism started to form around the group VACT UP and Gay Men's Health Crisis. And unfortunately, these gay groups were basically just parroting whatever the government said about the epidemic. And unfortunately, these groups didn't have a skeptical attitude towards science. They didn't really have a scientific attitude towards science. They became more like cults. And these cults basically focused on my paper as the, you know, the bearer of bad news, which was you're not being told the truth about the real nature of this epidemic. You know, and all of this was done through, you know, I think very serious evidence-based reporting. You know, this was not just sort of armchair theorizing, you know, in cockamamie editorials. I mean, I had some amazing reporters. You know, we started out with Lawrence Mass, a doctor, and then James DeRamo, who had a PhD, and then Ann Fettner wrote for us, and then the amazing John Lauritsen, who was, you know, a serious intellectual. And John did amazing investigative reporting on AZT and on Peter Duisberg, you know, and then, you know, in our final years, Nina Ostrom focused on the connection between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome and the virus HHV6. And in many ways, you know, my paper became synonymous with HHV6. It was difficult staying in business because ACT UP was, you know, made us their, you know, public enemy number one. And they finally voted to boycott us, and all kinds of weird stuff started happening. You know, our paper was often given away at, you know, bars and restaurants, and what would happen is people would just go in and take a, you know, the whole pile of newspapers and throw them in the garbage. So it's amazing that we stayed in business for as long as we did. Like I say, the story is detailed in Truth to Power, which is on Amazon. And it's on my website, charlesortlib.com.
How many people do you believe, as a guesstimate, were really behind the efforts to silence anyone who questioned the official version of AIDS?
I think it's actually a small group of people who know how to manipulate crowds. You know, I think in many ways ACT UP was manipulated by a handful of people. It just became so dangerous to ask questions. You know, it just, everyone needed to be on the same page. You know, in some ways, the paradigm calmed everyone down. You know, when Margaret Heckler made the announcement that HTLV-3, what became HIV, you know, was the cause of AIDS, there was tremendous relief. And, you know, because suddenly people thought they knew what the disease was, you know, what caused it and how to control it, and it wasn't this big mystery. So, you know, but I call that making a pact with the devil, because that wasn't the truth about the epidemic. And the problem is that people have tried to keep a lid on this, you know, ever since she made that announcement back in the 80s. And there's tremendous terror throughout the scientific community, the medical community, and the so-called AIDS community and the gay community, that, you know, that this could be a Pandora's box if we open it up again. And, we, you know, people don't want to go back to the bad old days where we kind of don't know exactly what's going on. So that's kind of why people who speak out are, you know, are terrorized, threatened, why careers are destroyed, like Peter Duesberg's, or harmed in one way or another. You know, people see what happens to newspapers and scientists who ask questions, and they just decide to be quiet.
If you were to give us a summary now of all these decades of research and knowledge that you have, how would you explain to just a regular citizen what is AIDS based upon what you know?
Well, you know, our newspaper did a lot of reporting on the virus that emerged after HIV. It's called HHV6. And Robert Gallo's lab supposedly discovered it. There's some question about that. There's some question about everything Robert Gallo discovered. And my line on HHV6 is that the Gallo, you know, stole credit for the wrong virus first. And, you know, once HIV was carved in stone, you know, no new data could really change the paradigm. The HIV paradigm was set. And my newspapers, you know, we kept our eye on medical developments that, you know, that questioned the paradigm, and the emergence of the chronic fatigue syndrome epidemic was the biggest challenge to the paradigm. And the similarities between chronic fatigue syndrome and AIDS were just completely amazing to us, and we covered that every week in the New York Native, Nina Ostrom did. And the more she covered chronic fatigue syndrome, the more obvious it became that they weren't two epidemics but one, and that the CDC had made a terrible error in separating AIDS from chronic fatigue syndrome. And they're suffering the consequences of that to this very day, because they don't know what to do about chronic fatigue syndrome. They don't know how to research it without telling the public that it overlaps with AIDS and that it's linked to this virus called HHV6. So, you know, from my perspective, we are in the middle of an HHV6 pandemic. And, you know, HHV6 should be on the front page of the New York Times every day. You know, if people want to know more about HHV6, I've been running something called HHV6 University online since 2005, or they can go to an establishment website called the HHV6 Foundation, which has a ton of research on HHV6. There's going to be a big HHV6 conference in Berlin in a few weeks. But, you know, the establishment doesn't really want to talk about HHV6. They're quietly doing all this research, and you see all this damage, all the damage HHV6 is associated with in AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome and in a number of other mysterious illnesses. You know, I tell people that just sit and watch television for a day, and you will see one ad after another for some illness that you didn't hear about before, whether it's like dry eyes or irritable bowel syndrome, you know, and say, you know, go online and look and see if HHV6 is associated with that, and then you'll see what the HHV6 epidemic is all about. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a major public health problem. You know, I would say it's up there with climate change in its threat to the human race right now. And I think, you know, the best way, and I wrote a book recently, it's free on my website at charlesortlib.com, called The Duesbergians, and in which I praise Peter Duesberg, by the way, for everything he did. But I raised the question of whether he would have been more effective if he had also focused on the link between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome, and if he had paid more attention to HHV6. Because I think that the problem with challenging the paradigm like HIV equals AIDS, is you need a compelling paradigm to replace it with. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And, you know, and the Duisbergian solution, or the Duisbergian paradigm is basically that there really isn't a contagious epidemic of AIDS. You know, and I respect Peter's thinking. I disagree with him about that. You know, I think that the problem is that there is a contagious epidemic. It's just way bigger than what we call AIDS and the HIV epidemic. It's the HHV6 epidemic. And, you know, whereas Peter thinks that the CDC has sort of concocted a fake epidemic, my argument is they're hiding a much bigger epidemic that's hidden in plain sight. And the gay community is only too happy to help them. And many in the chronic fatigue syndrome community are very happy to help in sort of covering this up, because they don't want their illness linked back to AIDS via HHV6. So they'd rather, you know, pursue any – they're on a wild goose chase to find a cause for chronic fatigue syndrome. They just don't want to talk about the AIDS connection.
Could you imagine that today we have more money spent on AIDS research around the world than on heart disease and cancer combined? That's how powerful that paradigm has become, and no one, no individual, no magazine can interfere in that entire process.
You know, many people years ago, you know, I've been at this for like 36 years, and many people thought that this was a house of cards. You know, I think that Peter Duisberg probably thought early on that if he spoke, you know, reason to power, that house of cards would come down. But the problem is that I call it a corrupted hard drive, that, you know, the hard drive has been corrupted from the very beginning. So all of that research is basically worthless and you know, ultimately may have to be retracted. And one of my strategic arguments with the Duisbergians is that I think they could have been more effective if they had, instead of like presenting themselves as dissidents or, you know, people that were presenting an intellectual challenge, they should have been acted more like whistleblowers and talked in terms of scientific crimes. And, you know, I think that's, if they were to ask me, what do we do to change this, I would say, you know, get Congress to investigate this as a crime, not as a mistake, but as a crime. And begin asking all of the scientific journals that have published articles based on the theory to begin retracting. And, you know, it's just a different way of approaching it. There may have been a handful of the Duisberg followers who spoke that way, but Peter is very collegial. He doesn't quite talk that way. And that may have been a mistaken strategy.
Charles, there's one other aspect, and I'll let you go after this.
Okay.
And that is that there is no statute of limitations when it comes to crimes against humanity. And I believe that there is far enough information available to prove that the people involved knew from the beginning, the manufacturers, the scientists, that AZT was not going to either stop, slow down, or reverse AIDS, and therefore push this just like they did Vioxx. They pushed it and people died. Tens of thousands died. And here, hundreds of thousands died. So that could be a class action lawsuit. And I even have attorneys looking into this now, because I believe that since the mainstream media will not talk about this and the gay media is controlled by those that support this, then this message will never get out. And those of you who were really fighting this and telling us the truth, your voices will not be heard. So I believe that we've got to get whistleblowers out. Give them a form. The government will never do an investigation on its own because there's too many people who have political input into people of power. But your idea is very, very feasible. Charles, I look forward to another conversation. In my personal opinion, you are a hero, not only in the gay community, but in the larger community, because you had the courage to tell the truth and to stand there in the blistering fire and take it. So this is a gay-on-gay crime that is not being covered by the media. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.